Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
Okay, so whilst we're waiting, perhaps I can tell you a little bit about who I am, and you can tell me a little bit about yourself. Of course, you know each other very well by now. I don't know any of you, and I have not read any of your CVs or anything, so I don't know which countries you're from, what you're studying, what you're doing, whether you have experience in cinema or not, so perhaps you can tell me about it. As for me, as you can see there, I'm a lecturer in English and translation. I teach in Rome. That's where my university is, UNINT. It's called the University of International Studies. It's a small university with three faculties, translation and interpreting, politics and economics. And so my job is to train aspiring interpreters and aspiring translators, including in audiovisual translation. I am a qualified conference interpreter, so that's where I'm coming from. And I first got interested in film translation when I was writing my MA dissertation, because I wanted to combine my love of film with my interest in languages and translation. So I decided to study subtitling, which 20 years ago was not really well known here in Italy, because as you probably know, it's a dubbing country. And so I got in touch with one of the leading directors of the time. Perhaps you've heard of him. He's called Nanni Moretti. And so I got in touch with him thinking, he's going to say, just go to hell, who are you? And he was really nice about my idea. I asked him if he would give me his film Dear Diary in the English and Spanish subtitle versions to compare them and see what the translation challenges were. And he was really pleased about it. So that was my first approach. Then after graduation, I also attended a course in audiovisual translation at City University in London. And after that, I kept working both as a film translator and as a lecturer. I taught in the UK first. I started my career at the University of Hull, which is near York, near Manchester, for about 6 years. And then I moved back to Italy, and I taught at my former university in Trieste, then in Forlì, Bologna, and now I'm in Rome. And last year, one of my courses was audiovisual translation, which is what I've basically based my presentation on today. So you will hear me talk about the practice of translation, but also the teaching, and also a bit of research. Because one of the things that you might be interested in is that we all go to the cinema, we all watch films with subtitles or dubbed or whatever, but it is practiced, but not a lot is known about the reception process, how viewers perceive those films. And so there are a lot of, I call them improvised film translators, who basically approach it very naively. Perhaps they work in literary translation, or they translate for newspapers or whatever, but they don't know the basics of film language, and that's a real problem, because it means that you see subtitles that really don't work on the image. Sometimes, not always, there's always exceptions, and there are always good translators everywhere. But anyway, so that's my background. So before I start, could you tell me a little bit about yourselves, where you're coming from, and why you're interested in cinema, why you're taking part in this initiative? You start. Up to you, I don't mind. Just introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Jeff from Luxembourg.
Okay.
I studied graphic design, actually, but I did a short video film as my final project.
Okay.
And I'm quite interested in doing more design stuff related to film or video,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
that would be motion design mostly.
So the graphic aspect?
The graphic aspect. I'm between two jobs at the moment, so I'm just finished my studies and looking for work and just figuring out what I'm gonna do.
Okay.
I find this translation workshop quite interesting because in Luxembourg we have French and German,
yeah.
Like official languages. So I was brought up like cinema wise or film wise
mm-hmm.
With. For example, in French TV, German films that were translated or dubbed pretty badly.
Yeah.
on the French side and the German side have a really strong and good dubbing culture, which is super weird. I don't know exactly why this is.
We'll talk about that in a bit. That's all right.
I was just talking about how the French can love at dubbing stuff.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Okay. So you know where you're from. Okay.
I find it super weird because they also choose the wrong. I don't know if you got the voice aspect of it, but they just use voices that doesn't match the face and stuff like that. The Germans get it right most of the time, but I also like sometimes to watch something in dub language or in Netflix, just choosing like one scene and having it in different languages, which is pretty fun to do actually. Yeah. And also just the voices, I'm always a little bit off-put if the voice doesn't match like the face, and especially if you know the real voice. So I'm looking forward to this.
Okay.
Sounds pretty interesting.
Good. Thank you.
I am Madara. I'm from Latvia, Riga. And I'm actually just graduated this year from film school. I was studying production of film and theater. And I've been also working on film sets as a casting person, just lately as a casting director, mostly like casting manager, for like 3 years. So that's why cinema. And about the translating, that's actually what I do. Aside from, like, when I don't have projects and I actually have, like, free time plus need the money.
Yes.
Like a combination.
And
I have a problem with sitting in an office, so I just, that's a good way how you can work anywhere, everywhere from whatever place in the world. So I started doing that, and I started actually with TV series.
Yeah.
Like, really stupid ones. And then I slowly, like, started going up, and now I'm also, like, I haven't done it for a while, like, you know, like, a few months because we were shooting a film, but the last thing was a film actually, so I'm kind of like stepping up. Of course, sometimes the films are really bad and I don't actually want to watch them, but I have to not only watch them but also watch them like several times to translate it properly. So that's why.
Okay, that's very interesting.
My name is Hannah, I'm from Poland, where I studied filmmaking. And quite recently I was also working as a script supervisor on some indie sets. And as for the translation, in Poland it used to be very popular to have voiceovers, so just one man was reading everything. And that was that always annoyed me, because when Polish people are dubbing films, it's pretty good, but still, subtitles is the choice I've always... were always my choice, so I owe them actually a lot, because that's how I probably learned most of English, so through the subtitles. So I think that's pretty much it.
Okay, good.
My name is Dikte, I'm from Denmark. I study dramaturgy, theater, but I'm basically mostly interested in writing for both like plays and also screenwriting. So in terms of translations, I have done like a short film documentary that I translated from Danish into English subtitles. But like in general, I don't know, I think Denmark is pretty good at... But I do find it interesting, like, you certainly see certain films where there are not necessarily mistakes, but things you would have done differently, find it interesting.
Thank you.
I'm Ben, I'm from Belgium, from Flanders, so the Dutch-speaking part. I studied languages, Dutch and Latin, so... Specifically for Latin, we had a lot of translation, or we put some sort of emphasis on that. And now I'm a freelance journalist, so I'm mostly busy with languages and stuff. And also like subtitling or translating, I'm thinking of doing a postgraduate of literary translation, so this might also be interesting.
There's a very good course in audiovisual translation in Antwerp.
It should. I'm thinking of going to Antwerp for
you. Yeah. No, I know quite a few people there, so if you need contacts, I can.
Okay. That's interesting. Thank you.
Okay. And you?
Okay, so I'm Dominika, I'm from Slovakia.
Okay.
I'm about to study art history, so cinema is not my profession, not even like languages or something.
Well,
so
it's related to art.
Yeah,
though,
it's really, so. It's like, yeah, it's a field of art, but I'm mostly going to be studying like paintings and mm-hmm. stuff. But cinema is my passion.
Okay.
Film is my passion. I chose this this workshop because I think subtitles and dubbing is like an essential part to make the film globally accessible, but it's
yes.
also like really underrated, especially
yes.
in Slovakia. Like people don't really realize how big of a part it is.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in Slovakia, dubbing is pretty bad, so I usually watch movies just subtitled.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also sometimes, if it's like a foreign movie, that if it's a movie not in English, then the subtitles are also not very trustworthy. Like if it's a French movie, I don't speak French that well, so yeah, hopefully that can change in time.
Yes, we'll talk about all these problems in the first part of the workshop. And we've got our French colleague.
Yes. So my name is Julie from France, and I'm a film student as well.
Okay.
What you said about French people who can't dub film is absolutely true.
I just don't get it. it got so rich, like film culture in France.
I know, yeah. And I actually work in two cinema, an art house cinema where all the films are in original version
yes.
with subtitles.
Yes.
And like mainstream cinema, and when you tell people they come to the one screening of the day that is going to be an original version, they're like, "Oh no,
yeah,
I don't want to come to this one." And that's and on the other cinema, people are like, they ask if the film is going to be subtitled.
Yes.
So I think there's like two different cultures in one same country.
Yes, I think the whole. I mean, in Italy, there's a whole debate.
Yeah.
You know, pro dubbing, pro subtitling.
Yeah.
Who's for? Who's against? And it dates back to the origin of the problem. I mean, first of all, I don't know whether you're aware of it, but the whole problem of film translation first came along when they invented sound,
mm-hmm.
you know, talkies. Because
yeah.
before that, they just needed to translate a few intertitles,
yeah.
you know, the captions
mm-hmm.
that appeared. It was literally 20 intertitles in a whole film, and it wasn't very difficult. And that's why, you know, the silent films traveled everywhere. But when they invented sound, on the one hand, it was a great technological accomplishment, which opened up, you know, new possibilities for cinema. But at the same time, it created lots of problems in terms of exporting films and importing films. And so there was a period at the end of the 30s. The first talkie is called The Jazz Singer. It came out
mm-hmm.
in 1927. End of the 20s, early 30s, they experimented a lot, trying to find, you know, the best solution for it. So the first solution they came up with, which was short-lived, but it's fun, so I'll mention it, is the so-called multiple versions. So they had the same set, but different film stars, depending on the language. So they would use the same set to shoot the same scene in English, in German, in American, in Spanish, in Italian, whatever. But of course, there was a bit of a downside, you know, when they shot The Big Trail with John Wayne, who was the leading character, you know, the cowboy, etc. The film travelled to Italy in the Italian version, but people wanted to watch John Wayne. They didn't want to watch whatever his name was from the Italian colony in Los Angeles. Nobody knew him, so it didn't really work. Then somebody thought, well, why don't we use the same method that we use for post-synchronization. Now, post-synchronization was something that they already did in those times because recording conditions were not very good at the time. You know, the technology they were using was not very sound sensitive, and so it picked up lots of noise. And sometimes they had to redub the whole scene in the dubbing studio, except they didn't call it dubbing, they didn't use it for translation. They used the same actor to repeat the same line, but in, you know, soundproof situation. So somebody thought, well, we'll just use the same system, but get somebody to translate the lines into another language. And so they, of course, it took a while to get it right. They experimented a bit, and then this was the invention of dubbing. So roughly 1932-33, it was already up and running, working quite well. Same thing with subtitles. Somebody said, okay, we'll just use intertitles. We've been using them for years successfully. We'll keep using the same system. But then as talkies got more and more talkative, you know, directors began to write scripts with lots and lots of dialogue, you couldn't have 200 intertitles because a two-hour film would last 4 hours and people would get bored. So they thought, oh, okay, hang on, we'll use the same system of, you know, translating in writing, but we'll try and put those writings on, actually on the physical film. So they had to invent a way to do it. The first way they invented was chemical. So they would basically use some chemicals to burn the characters onto the film. It was still acetate at the time. It was very flammable. You know, it went up in flames quite easily. Mm-hmm. Then they used an optical system, which meant they prepared all the subtitles on strips of paper, basically, and then they took photographs of them together with the film. So they would photograph the entire film with the captions, which was a bit, you know, it took a while. And then they invented something quite similar to Gutenberg's printing press, but for film. So it basically burnt the characters onto the film without using strange chemical solvents. So it was a lot neater, and the contours of the letters were much better. You could read them properly. And then, of course, in the roughly mid-80s, beginning of the 90s, they started using laser. So now you still burn the characters onto the picture if you're using actual film, of course. I'm not talking about digital film. So if you're still using actual film, and some filmmakers do use it still, you use laser to burn the characters onto the film. Then they invented digital technology, which made everything much easier because you basically prepare the subtitles on the computer and then you mix them into the image effortlessly, basically. Just one person can manage the whole process. But anyway, before we have a look at the actual specificities of both dubbing and subtitling, I thought perhaps we needed to define a few things, a few notions, because we'll be using them today and tomorrow. A notion I'd like to introduce to you is the notion of accessible filmmaking and accessibility. Now, the word accessibility has been used until now to refer to all the measures that you can take to make places accessible to disabled people. But it also means making entertainment, culture, and information accessible to disabled people or to people who don't know the language in which that cultural artifact is produced. So in a wide sense, the term accessibility includes audiovisual translation and includes all the techniques that have been invented to make films accessible to blind and deaf people. Okay, so it's a wide concept. By accessible filmmaking, which is a concept that's been suggested for the first time by colleague of mine who now teaches at the University of Vigo, but was at the University of Roehampton for many years, where he used to run an audiovisual translation and filmmaking course, and he's a filmmaker himself. He's called Pablo Romero Fresco. The concept of accessible filmmaking basically means making filmmakers aware of the basic constraints and needs of foreign language audiences and sensory disabled audiences, so that they can take those needs into account in pre-production, production, and post-production. But one of the problems that we as film translators encounter today is that film translation is generally a post-production operation. You basically, you know, filmmaker shoots the film, then they edit the film comes out, and the very last thing they think about is translation. If the film, for example, has been accepted for an international festival like Venice. So it's not something that's at the back of their mind when they are preparing the film. Now, what the concept of accessible filmmaking tries to suggest is that if you know what's involved in the translation process, you can plan the shooting of your film to make translation and any accessibility form like audio description or subtitles for the deaf and hard of hearing to make them easier and better. Right? One of the problems that we have is that generally, because it is a post-production operation, the translator or accessibility expert works independently from the creative team, no contact whatsoever with the director or the screenwriter. So we can't ask them, what did you exactly mean when you said this? When the character uses that word, what nuance did you want to give to that word? And it's, sometimes it's important to know, because across different languages, a certain concept might be expressed in a completely different way. So if you have no way of getting in touch with the authors, with the creators, then you basically trust your own intuition. Sometimes you get it right, sometimes you get it wrong. Also, some film dialogues are very, can be full of cultural references, puns, idioms, imagery, symbolic meanings, and so on, which the screenwriters and film director work on for months. So if you think about it, it's actually quite strange that the film translator should be asked to translate the film in maybe 3 days, with no possibility of asking any questions to anybody. You have to be really, really good to produce a good translation under those conditions. So what you were saying, one of you were saying before, is exactly the key point here. The fact that most films nowadays obtain about half of their revenue from foreign language versions, dubbed or subtitles. 50% is a lot of money. It's a huge amount. So, how much of the budget is spent on foreign language versions or accessible versions for the blind and the deaf? Between 0.1% and 1% of the budget, which is a ridiculous amount. So what we're trying to say here is not that we film translator want more money. That's not the key point. Although if they give us a bit more money, we're happy. But that's not the point. The point is, if it takes you, screenwriter, to write the script, if it takes you maybe 2 months or 3 months and you discuss certain words, certain scenes with the film director for hours and hours, why should you not allow the film translator to be part of the whole project from the beginning, at least to sit in certain meetings so that you are informed of the difficulties that will come up, so you have time to think of possible translation solutions? Think of any Woody Allen film with all the jokes and the puns that they make up, which might be almost untranslatable in certain languages. If you have time to think of good solutions, perhaps you might find something that actually works. But if they give you, but if the film is dumped on your desk and they say it has to be ready by Friday and it's Wednesday, you do your best, right? So that's one idea. You basically try to integrate accessible filmmaking. You integrate translation and accessibility from the pre-production stage. The idea is that you appoint somebody as a translation and accessibility expert, and that person is invited to 1, 2, 3 meetings by the creative team so that you are informed about the project and you follow its development. And then, of course, you actually start working on the translation on the finished product, but at least you've had time to think about it. Okay, and you also have time to give suggestions to the director in terms of how to shoot certain scenes. Now, nobody here wants to limit the creative liberty of directors, but if they know, for example, how long you need to display a certain subtitle, perhaps before they change the shot, they can wait an extra second, which doesn't change that much, but it makes our job a whole lot easier. If they don't know, they'll just do it, you know, the way they want, and then then it's our problem. Okay? So, it has a social function, of course, accessibility. It means that the hurdle, as I said, can be language or sensorial barrier, but the aim is exactly the same, to make the product accessible to viewers who otherwise would not be able to watch that film and understand that film. So, as I said, translation in a wider sense. But of course, when it comes to actual interlinguistic translation from one language to another, there are different ways of translating a film. The most, well, the most important ones, the best known ones are dubbing, subtitling, and voiceover, but there's also others. And in terms of accessibility, the best known ones are subtitles for the deaf, audio description for the blind, but there's also audio introductions and audio titles, and we'll talk about those tomorrow. If you have any question at all at any point, just interrupt me. So, where do we start from? Of course, we start from the film. Now, if you consider the film as the text that we have to translate, the first thing you have to bear in mind is that it's a very special kind of text. It's polymedial. It uses two channels, sound and images, combined. And what do you translate? You translate verbal signs, meaning that you translate film dialogues and the songs, and these are the acoustic verbal signs. There are also non-verbal signs, noises, music, sound effects, and so on, which you don't translate. Then visual verbal signs also need translations. If you have an email, a text message, a newspaper headline, a telegram, a letter, or whatever, in shot, and it's important for the plot, you have to translate that as well. And then, of course, the images. Yes?
Am I mistaken, or was there a thing in Wonder Woman at mm-hmm. the end where she is getting like a letter mm-hmm. from Batman?
Possibly, yeah. I haven't
seen
it. And
it
what
was
happened?
Translated in the letter. So, in the film. It was not even subtitled, but it was...
Oh, sometimes
yes,
that.
I was going to say that. Now, with digital film...
That's so
with
crazy.
Digital film, they can actually replace the writing yeah. physically. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you see it in your language already.
So it becomes like post-production. That's like editor's
yes. stuff. Yeah. Yes, but yes.
It's kind of strange because... Doing it like draws you from the story because
yeah,
you know it's not in
yes,
the
I was
going to
say that. It's a matter of choice. I personally, if I were subtitling that film, I would use the subtitles because you see that the film is set in America or wherever. Mm. So it would be a bit bizarre to see a piece of writing in Italian. You know, as a viewer, you think, okay, why are they writing to Wonder Woman in Italian? Who's that? If you are dubbing the film... a solution they often find, they often use, is to use a so-called interior monologue. So you hear Wonder Woman's voice as if she were reading it out loud.
Yeah.
And you can use it if she's not in shot, if her face is not visible. So if they are, you know, if in shot you see the letter, then you hear her voice reading it. So it's a neat way of doing that, I think.
It's also sometimes confusing in the dubbing when they use like references from the country because, like, I don't know, my younger brother who's like 10 and he thinks, oh, but that's Polish stuff, and I'm like explaining to
yes.
him, yeah, but that's only in the dubbing. They didn't say that in the original.
Yes, that is one of the problems. As a translator, I can say that you always have to try and strike the right balance between. A faithful translation and a functional translation. So, for example, I conducted a study on the Italian dubbing of The Good Wife. I don't know if you've seen the series. It's a courtroom drama. She's a lawyer, and she goes to court to represent various people. And of course, it's full of references to the American legal system, which is very different from the Italian legal system. If you were to translate those references very accurately, like a law professor would do in a book, then the end result would not be comprehensible for mass viewers because they have no idea what the grand jury is. They don't know what powers it has and things like that. On the other hand, if you translate those references using Italian references, so for example, instead of saying public prosecutor, you use the Italian term for that, then you're introducing an element of absurdity because you know that she's an American barrister in an American court of law. So what you have to try and do in those cases is to translate the function and make sure that viewers understand what that reference means, even though it might not be exactly accurate. Because otherwise, as you say, you know, you're watching the film and you're going, hang on, do they have those in America? I thought this was Polish. That's not a good translation, evidently. In that case, perhaps the translator made it too obvious, made the effort to domesticate the text too much. We'll see what that means in a minute. Dubbing goes towards domestication, whereas subtitling goes towards foreignization, and I'll explain what it means in a minute. Why did I draw this diagram? Simply to explain that when you're dealing with interlinguistic translation from one language to another, you translate this stuff here, the acoustic verbal signs and the visual verbal signs, so here on the left-hand side of the screen, but you don't translate those in isolation from the rest. You translate them in a way that makes sure that they are integrated well with what you see on the right-hand side. So your translation can never contradict the images. It can never be at variance with the sound effects or the music. And it can't anticipate certain sound effects or music. Think of a thriller, of a horror film, and things like that. You can't reveal in words what's going to come up later on. You know, there's a monster, a killer, or whatever. You have to, you know, mince your words and make sure that your translation integrates smoothly with the very complex text. And this is something that our clients sometimes don't understand. So some film translators simply receive a script without the images, and they tell them, you translate this. And it's impossible. I mean, certain things like a simple sentence in English, like, look at this, is impossible to translate in Italian if you don't know what this is, because we have feminine and masculine gender. So is it a person, an object? Is it a masculine object, like a table, tavolo? Or is it a feminine object, finestra? So if I don't see what the character is pointing at, I can't translate that sentence. A friend of mine, a colleague, was here at the Venice Film Festival a few years ago doing simultaneous interpreting during a film, which is an emergency measure that they have to take whenever there's no time to produce the subtitled versions. It doesn't happen very often, but if a director sends you the film literally the night before the screening, there's no time to subtitle it. So you have interpreters in the booth, first time they watch the film, trying to interpret what the characters are saying. Of course, it's really, really difficult. So this colleague of mine was interpreting from, I think, from a Swedish film or something. And anyway, there was a sentence that meant, this person will come later on. And he didn't know whether that person was a man or a woman. So, you know, he tried it, chance, and translated it as if it were a man. And then she walked on in the image, visibly pregnant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the audience were going, what's happening? Who's this woman? I was expecting a male character. So that's a very silly example, but it can prove to you that in order to translate this stuff, you need to have a look at that stuff. Okay, because the film is a whole. It's a whole thing. So, which is what, you know, these professors mean when they say an audiovisual text is a semiotic construct woven by a series of signifying codes that operate simultaneously to produce meaning. It's a very complex way of saying what I've just said to you in simple words. So, what do? You have to take into account the possible impacts of all the components, linguistic and non-linguistic, in your translation choices. Okay? So, what do we translate and how? These are some of the audiovisual translation modes that exist today. So, if you ask anybody who's not an expert, audiovisual translation, what does it make you think of? They'll probably say dubbing or subtitling, and that's it. But it's much more complex than that. They have been classified according to revoicing or titling categories. Revoicing means all the techniques that basically replace the original voice of the actors, whereas titling, all sorts of different subtitles, surtitles, intertitles, depending on what we're dealing with. So post-synchronization is what I was telling you before when they invented dubbing. It's intralingual, it's from one language to the same language. And in Italy, we used it a lot, especially in the 1950s, just after the war, because most of the theatres in Cinecittà had been destroyed by the bombs. And so to shoot Italian films, people like Zavattini or people like Fellini, for example, they had to shoot in the streets. But as I was saying before, their equipment was not as sensitive as it is today, and so sometimes I had to read out certain scenes, and they use post-synchronization quite often. It's interesting because if you watch the Fellini films, his stars were most of them came from beauty pageants. They'd won Miss Italy or Miss Cinema or whatever, and so initially they couldn't act. Then they took acting lessons. Even somebody like Sophia Loren, that's where she came from. So originally, you know, she wouldn't be able to say her lines properly. So Fellini would simply say to her, count up to 100. So you see her lips moving, but she's just saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, etc. And then later on in the dubbing studio, after a few months, after she studied acting and she knew how to say her lines, you know, she would actually say the lines of the script. So that's a bit of a let's say it's an artistic use of post-synchronization. Then voiceover, as we've heard before, it was the main method used in a lot of former Soviet countries or Eastern Bloc countries, but it is also used in the West. It was used primarily for things like TV interviews and documentaries. Now it is used for reality shows, you know, artistic creations like, I don't know, Big Brother and things like that. You don't want to spend too much money dubbing Big Brother because there's loads of people and it's rubbish, basically. So why would you want to pay so many actors to dub that? You have voiceover and that's more than enough. It can tell you everything you need to know about what they're saying. Then commentary and narration are variations on the same theme. Simultaneous interpreting, I've just told you about it, as an emergency backup measure. Then audio description is basically a description, narration of the film, the entirely, the purely visual scenes in a film. It is a service aimed at the blind. So the blind can watch a film and understand the dialogues with no problem, but if there are lots of scenes where nobody speaks, they don't know what's going on, and so there is an audio description script that is recorded in a dubbing studio by a professional speaker or a dubber that basically is mixed with the soundtrack of the original film and describes what's going on, giving enough clues to the blind to understand what's happening. And we'll talk about it better tomorrow. Plus audio introduction sometimes. Then titling, you know everything about subtitling, of course. Interlingual subtitles, we're all used to them. And SDH, or subtitling for the deaf and hard of hearing. And we'll talk about it tomorrow. Then digital subtitling is what is used in festivals like Venice. I'm sure you've all seen the subtitles physically in the picture, but also another version that is projected onto a smaller screen at the bottom. And it's used in festivals so that you can have two language versions without crowding too much the image, without taking up too much space. Surtitling is used in theatres, so not in the cinema, but I thought I'd mention it because it's quite interesting. It's used for opera and for plays. And of course, it is not aimed only at the deaf, but also at ordinary people, especially opera. I mean, I'm Italian, but I don't understand a word when they're saying, when they sing, you know, bel canto, it's beautiful, but what are they saying? No idea whatsoever. Live subtitling is something I specialize in, but we're not going to have time to talk about this today. I'll just mention it briefly so you know that it exists. Live subtitling is what you do with live events, conferences or sporting events or the news on television. What else? A declaration of the President of the United States, breaking news on TV. You can't have somebody typing the subtitles. Or rather, you can, if you have a stenotypist, using a special machine that basically, where the keys represent syllables. And that way you can keep up with the pace, otherwise it's impossible. If you haven't got a stenotypist at hand, you use a re-speaker. A re-speaker uses speech recognition technology. You train the computer to recognize your voice. You repeat what the President of the United States is saying, and you also add punctuation so that you transform what the President is saying into a written text. So you say things like, ladies and gentlemen, comma, it is a pleasure for me to be here addressing this audience today, full stop, new line, and things like that. Of course, it takes a specially trained person to do that, or you work in pairs. Sometimes you have a re-speaker working and then an editor correcting any typos or misrecognitions. Audio subtitling, which I'll mention briefly today, but we're not going to have time to explore it properly, is basically an oral, a spoken version of subtitles. Because what do you do if you are an English blind person who loves Pedro Almodovar, and you want to watch. I say watch because the blind don't mind if you're using these words. You can refer to eyes and views and sight and so on. It doesn't make them any less blind. So you can call them blind and you can say watch a film quite happily. They say it. So anyway, if a blind person wants to go to the cinema to watch a Pedro Almodovar film with their friends, you know, their friends can read the subtitles. But the person is blind, and he can't understand Spanish because he's English. So what do? You have audio subtitles, meaning a spoken version of the same subtitles that your friends are reading. Now, this can be done either in a reserved, private, confidential way, meaning that you download a special app onto your smartphone, and you put on your headsets, so that basically only you hear the audio subtitles, or it can be done openly if it's an accessible projection, an accessible screening, so that everybody can hear it.
Actually, I have two questions.
Yes!
So I think Julie did it as well during the Q&As. The questions were always in Italian, and as we watched many French production, the answers were in French,
and
we wanted to translate it to like the people sitting around us and the jury. And I found it super hard. How do translators do it? Like listening to a phrase and then saying it, and then but still listening to the rest of the.
It takes a special training. Yeah. That's what I studied when I was in Trieste in the Department of Translation and Interpreting, and that's what I'm teaching now. You basically do certain exercises to teach you, they're called dual task training. You basically train your brain to work dichotically. So it helps if you're a bit neurotic yourself. It's already a start. You're basically listening to the foreign language with only one ear, and you are listening to yourself with the other ear to check your production and make sure that you're not talking complete rubbish.
Yeah.
So it takes a while. I mean, the course I did was 2 years general translation plus 2 years doing simultaneous interpreting and consecutive interpreting. So it is quite labor-intensive. I think anybody can learn it as long as they practice a lot. But like with everything that is you know, a craft and an art at the same time. I think there are some people who are naturally gifted for it. So, you know, to my students, I always say, if you work hard enough, you'll get there. But some of you will become great interpreters, and some of you will become, you know, run-of-the-mill interpreters. But we need, you know, good, very good, and excellent translators. There's work for everyone. So, just simply because we haven't got much time today, but to satisfy your curiosity, one of the exercises that you do initially when you first go into the booth is to listen to a story being told by the teacher or on tape, and it's generally a fairy tale that you already know, but with some variations. Say Little Red Riding Hood, but you know, in the end, she shoots the wolf or something. And at the same time, as you're listening, you are requested to count from 1 to 100 or to count backwards. So two completely unrelated types of information. The rationale behind it is that you don't need to pay 100% of your attention to the fairy tale because you know most of it. You only need to pick up on the variations on the theme. And at the same time, you don't need to pay 100% of your attention to the counting either, because by the time you're 22, you know, supposedly, you know how to count to 100. Supposedly. I mean, some of my students don't like mathematics very much. So whenever they hear a figure, they go, ugh. So that's one way of starting. And then you basically train them to differentiate between key information and secondary information. Whenever people talk, there's always a key idea behind it, and other stuff is frills or packaging, and you can get rid of it. And you have to get rid of some of it because you can never speak at exactly the same speed as the original speaker. And of course, some speakers are not very good speakers, so sometimes it's not clear even to themselves what they want to say. And so in those situations, you have to pay attention to what they're saying, much more to you know, to the incoming speech than to what you're saying, because otherwise you don't understand a word. Same thing happens first time you interpret from, I don't know, somebody with a thick Glaswegian accent. If you've never been exposed to it, you have to, you know, just listen with 2 ears, 4 years, 6 years, give me all the ears you've got, because, you know, I'm not used to that kind of accent. After a while, you get used to how they twist and change as well. So, it takes a while. But anyway, if you have more questions about it, I'm quite happy to answer. Anyway, so, you know all about this, right? You've seen that there are intralingual, interlingual, live, pre-recorded, with or without diamesic shift modes of translation. Diamesic shift means simply a change in medium from... So, you have no diamesic shift when you are translating from spoken to spoken language, like in dubbing. You have diamesic shift in subtitling when you go from spoken language to written language, or written to spoken, like in audio titles, or visual to verbal, like in audio description. Okay? What was I going to say? There was something that just came to my mind now to mention. It will come back to me. So, we've seen the history, right? We haven't seen the reasons for the choice of dubbing or subtitling. So why did countries like Italy, Germany, and Spain go for dubbing, and why did other smaller countries like Denmark or Sweden go for subtitling? Well, I'm afraid it's got nothing to do with art. It's got everything to do with politics and history. Italy, Germany, Austria, which was the same thing at the time, and Spain, they were all under dictatorships. So Mussolini, Franco, and Hitler. They did not want foreign films to arrive into their countries without being able to control the messages. And also there was some kind of protectionist measure behind it as well. They didn't want foreign languages being spoken in the country, For example, here in Italy, in those times, when they published William Shakespeare's plays, they translated his name and surname. Guglielmo. Yeah, I'm not joking. Guglielmo Fortebraccio or something. And so if you translated the film with, I don't know, Gregory Peck or Mr. Deeds Goes to Washington, you know, the Frank Capra films of the 1930s and 40s, Katharine Hepburn, that kind of era, all the characters' names were translated into Italian. So if somebody was called Thomas, they would become Tommaso, which of course sounded weird because then you saw that they were in Hollywood. It didn't make any sense. But they didn't want any foreign names. They didn't want... They wanted to promote the use of the national language for good reason, in a way. The political reason, the idea that they would be able to manipulate unsuitable messages, of course, is something that, to modernize anyway, is completely unacceptable. But the protectionist measures that they took to promote their own national cinema are, on the other hand, a little bit more understandable, more comprehensible, because at the time, like now, the US had almost a virtual monopoly over cinema. So when sound was invented and they opened theatres in Italy, in Germany, in Spain, etc., they tried to promote national production as much as possible. And they also saw dubbing as a possible outlet for that production because you needed dubbing actors for that. I don't know about Germany and Spain, probably not so much, but in Italy it was also an educational move in the sense that the country had been unified only at the end of the 19th century. 1861 is when the whole country was unified. So basically, Italian as a national language didn't really exist. It was imposed by law, and with the results that people in Piedmont, in the north, could not speak to people in Sicily because they spoke completely different dialects, and also foreign languages. In Turin, they spoke French. They were related to the Savoy family. In other parts of Italy, they spoke German and so on. So it was a way of strengthening the national language as well. Then, of course, there was also another problem. The high illiteracy rate that we had made it quite difficult to go for subtitles because it would mean that a lot of people would be excluded because they couldn't read. They couldn't read the subtitles. Other countries, smaller countries, or rather... not in terms of size, but in terms of population, they went for subtitling because they had no choice. So countries like Belgium or Holland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, etc., they all went for subtitling because it is immensely cheaper than dubbing. They didn't have enough people to make it worthwhile to dub the film. They wouldn't be able to recuperate the money, basically. So, and why... Now, the unexpected consequence, as I was saying, is that deaf and hearing impaired people lost access to film. You know, during the silent film era, they were part of the community, and then all of a sudden, they were not cinema goers anymore. They couldn't understand talkies at all. Now, in recent years, in the last 10 years or so, the whole industry has changed a lot. Because of internet-based platforms like Netflix, because now it is possible to have on-demand video, multiple language versions with SDH, audio description services, and so on, which were not common in the past. Where we are still struggling, I think, is to have the same kind of range of opportunities in cinema theatres. In actual physical cinemas, there's not that many cinemas that offer accessible screenings. In the UK, there's about 40 cinema theatres where they offer accessible versions. In Italy, only in Rome and Milan, as far as I know. And in festivals, like here in Venice, and in Turin, and so on. But they are occasional you know, one-off opportunities. So if you are a blind or deaf person, you still tend to consume most of your cinema at home, thanks to things like Netflix. Okay, which is a shame, of course.
Actually, if I may, when I was working in another cinema in Manchester as a projectionist, and so I had to test the audio description kits, and there were so few people who came and asked for it that they were so old, the kits, and when I had to test it, the quality was so bad, it was unbearable to listen to it. It was some infrared technology or something.
Yeah.
And so this is the opposite of accessibility, because...
Yes. That's an old technology they started using in the early 90s, and it's not been updated yet. And of course now with the digital projector and everything, it would be so much easier if they have like proper systems. But the trouble is, it's a vicious circle. It seems as if there's no demand simply because the blind and the deaf are so used to being excluded that they don't ask for these services. Some of them don't even realize that they exist.
Yeah, I think many people don't even know that it's a thing.
So that's why we are trying, starting from the university, but also with workshops like this, we're trying to spread awareness that these things exist and that people have a right to ask for them. And it's not just a matter of, we'll talk about it tomorrow, it's not just a matter of, you know, a moral issue. You know, you have to provide these services to them because it's fair. It's not just that. There's also an economic issue. You know, they are part of potential audiences. So if you are a director and these people exist and they're quite happy to pay your ticket, you make sure that your film is accessible. If it is accessible, they will come to the cinema and they will pay the ticket. You must not see disabled people simply as, you know, people to be pitied and helped. They don't want to be helped. They want us to facilitate access, but they are like anybody else. They enjoy going to the cinema, very simply. So, nowadays, the main dubbing countries are Austria, France, Germany, Italy and Spain, of course. Then voiceover dubbing, the former Soviet bloc, but also in combination with subtitling in some cases. Less so in some countries, more in other countries. Subtitling, purely subtitling, these are the countries, Belgium, Cyprus, Denmark, Finland, etc., etc., etc. The UK and Ireland are a special case. They are subtitling countries, technically, in the sense that when they import foreign language films, they do subtitle, but it's a tiny, tiny quota of their market. So it's the opposite situation that we are in. So we import... In Italy, we import maybe 80 or 90% of the films that we watch from the US, from the UK, Australia, English language speaking countries. And so our audiovisual industry is huge. You know, there's lots of stuff that needs translating. In the UK and Ireland, they tend to import lots of stuff from America, but it's already in English, so they don't need to translate anything. Although the opposite is not true. You might be surprised, but when English films are exported to America, they either remake them directly, that's easier, they either remake them or they actually distribute them dubbed or subtitled because they claim that they cannot understand British accent. Forget it. We'll not go there. It's ridiculous. We'll not go there.
It makes sense if it's like a period piece.
Yeah.
Like Peterloo was also at times, I was happy that there was a line.
Yes. Yes.
That's something different. I guess.
But at the same time, you know, if you're watching Sense and Sensibility, you don't want to remake Jane Austen in an American accent, do you? It doesn't make any sense.
And it's not the same audience as the Hollywood blockbuster
What I don't understand is why we should make the effort to understand American accent and they should not make the effort to understand British accent.
And I think it was only recently that accents actually became more like various. They not just using received pronunciation.
Very true.
But they use like Irish, like South Londonian whatever.
That's certainly very true. The rise of dialect films or multilingual films with different communities being portrayed. is certainly recent. Before, in the 80s and 90s, there was only people like Mike Lee and Ken Loach who used to set their stories in different parts of the UK, so you would hear people speaking Liverpudlian and Glaswegian, but not in other movies. Now there's lots of new authors from the UK who are exploiting the huge variety that there is in terms of accents in the UK, and so we're getting more exposed to Geordie and things like that. You need subtitles for Newcastle. I mean, English people need subtitles for Newcastle. Anyway, so that's basically it. We've seen that. So we'll talk a little bit about dubbing, and then we'll see how much time we've got. If we haven't got much time to talk about subtitling, perhaps we can use a little bit of tomorrow's workshop to finish off this presentation, because it's linked to what I will be describing tomorrow. Anyway, just briefly, so for your information, how a film is dubbed. Well, first you buy the rights, you import it. You choose a dubbing director, who is literally a director, but he casts the voices. So he selects the best available dubbers, depending on their voice pitch, their voice quality, trying to ensure that it is as similar as possible to the original actor's voice. If that dubber is free, you know, but there's a more limited range, a more limited pool of dubbing actors than the range of original actors. So you have, one of the problems of dubbing is that viewers get used to a certain voice. We had a very good actor who for years dubbed both Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. So to Italian ears, Al Pacino and Robert De Niro have got the same voice. Then the film Heat came out, and that was a nightmare. But this actor, he was great. He's dead now, so we have a new voice now, but that's one of the other downsides of dubbing. What do you do when, you know, the dubber dies? You have to replace him. But anyway, this dubber was really, really good and was able to change his voice to ensure that Al Pacino sounded a bit more like Al Pacino and Robert De Niro sounded different. But he was like a ventriloquist, basically. He acted the whole film himself. He's great. Anyway, so you choose the dubbing director. He casts the voice talents. Then the dialogue track is extracted from the film, because what you have left with is called the international soundtrack, which is the sound effects, the music, the noise, background, etc. You extract the dialogue track. If the production company has not provided a dialogue list, which is like a detailed script, you produce that dialogue list so that the translator has something to work on. Then you choose a translator. Generally, dubbing studios have their own, you know, pool of collaborators, people who work for them. The translator translates the dialogue, and if he or she is able to, he also adapts the dialogue, meaning he produces a rough translation first and then tries to change the lines to make sure that they match the images. And we'll see what I mean in a minute. So sometimes you have two different people, a translator and an adapter, but sometimes it's the same person who has both skills and does everything. Then, recording in the dubbing studio, shifts are organized. So if you have a dialogue between two actors, you try to ensure that they are present on the same day. If it's not possible because they have either, one of them has engagements elsewhere, one person comes in, records his part, then the other person goes in later on and records his part, so they're literally speaking to thin air, which is a bit odd, but they're used to it. Then, of course, there's a sound specialist who's present in the studio who is able to, you know, mix the sound smoothly into the original soundtrack to make sure that, you know, it's the same recording level and you can't tell that it's been altered. So you basically do the mixing and then you have the dub film. So you have all these people, and as I said, translator and adapter could be the same person. Sometimes translator, adapter, and dubbing director are the same person, or translator, adapter, and dubber, but not necessarily, because a dubber is not necessarily a translator. A dubber is an actor. They might be exclusively dubbing actors or theatre actors who also do dubbing, film actors who also do dubbing, etc. And the dubbing studio. We haven't got time to see the clip, but it doesn't really matter. So what did I mean by adapting the dialogue? The main goal is invisibility. So the idea is that you try to ensure that viewers don't realize that something has been changed. So you need to ensure that the lines in the foreign language, in the target language into which you are translating, match the lip movements of the actor and also the general face movements and the gestures and the whole physicality of the person. So how do you do that? You have lip sync, which is the compatibility between the sounds and the lip movements, but also isochrony, which means that your translated line must have the same duration as the original lines. You can't have the dub line going on forever and you know, you see that the actor has shut their mouths, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. Yes.
So when you need to translate a sentence and then you have the perfect words that means exactly what you want it to mean,
mm-hmm.
but then it doesn't match the lips and the
you change it.
You change it.
Sometimes you change the meaning completely.
Okay. Just the main purpose is that.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have to. Of course, you try to stay as close to the original idea as possible, but sometimes you can't help it.
Okay.
Have you heard about the pretty recent project on, I think it's on Italian universities and in Heidelberg in Germany, where they are able to put another mouth from an actor on the face of another
video?
They
actually manipulate the image.
Yeah, so
yes.
I forgot the name, I could look it up, but that
it
must
was on Jimmy Kimmel, I think.
Yeah, so they did it there, and I think this is gonna be like quite revolutionizing.
Yes,
like,
it would make our job so much easier.
If they would invest in that topic. Because that's just like it's the mouth of the actor,
yeah.
It's not gonna change, just the movement.
Yeah. Because you see, as I put here, not everything is a challenge. I mean, some sounds look very similar across different languages, but other sounds which really change, they really affect the shape of the lips, the shape of the mouth, are challenges. Vowels, vowel sounds. In Italian, they're all very open, very clear. A, E, I, O, U. You open your mouth a lot. And labiodental consonants. You know, p, f. They, you know, it's so obvious. If that person says mum, you know, you have to put something quite similar there, okay? But also kinesic sync, meaning that, of course, actors don't act just with their voice, but also with their body, their gestures, their facial expressions. And they're not always shared across different languages. Some gestures might be completely incomprehensible to another culture. So I don't know if in all of your culture this thing means the same, or if it even exists. Any idea what this gesture means?
You're like, are you crazy?
Are you crazy,
okay.
Or that's smart?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, we also have
smart.
It. But it depends if you.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's
smart. Well, you.
Okay.
You leave. I think you leave the.
I think.
Do you do this?
This thing.
Okay, so you see, there's variation there already. Well, in Italian, it's more like, are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? So not smart at all. It's not a compliment. As you can see, there's different nuances of meaning, and sometimes if it's really important that the viewers understand what was meant, you have to add something to the line, perhaps replace something that was in the spoken line to replace it with the meaning of that gesture. For example, there was a police thriller. I don't know if it's distributed in your countries. The Detective Montalbano series, do you know it? Have you ever heard of it? It's based on some thrillers, Italian thrillers set in Sicily. And so there was this scene in which a police agent was talking about an incident in which he had to intervene, And he said, and then, you know, Maurizio took out a gun. He's a bit soft in the head. He's, you know, he's the loony in the family. And he was going like this. And in the American version, in the subtitle, they actually added, he is the loony. He is a loony in the family. Which is not something that the character had said. He'd simply gone, he took up the gun, you know, Maurizio. And in the subtitle it went, he took up the gun, Maurizio is a loon. So you need to explicitate the information, because otherwise the viewers will not understand what that gesture means.
Okay. Does this mean something different in America, or do they just don't?
It doesn't exist. Okay. They don't do this at all in America, so they don't understand it. So just to show you an example of the constraints of dubbing, and also as a tribute to Neil Simon, who died last week. I don't know if you heard about this. He was a very famous playwright, active in the theatre and in film, especially in the 50s and 60s. And he wrote quite a few plays with that then became films with Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. And if you haven't seen The Odd Couple, I suggest you watch it, because it's one of the most hilarious comedies I've ever seen. It's just to give you an idea of the difficulties involved in dubbing, not just in terms of... Oops.
We lost power.
What's going on?
No, there's no electricity.
The power cut. Because the light was on.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And so were the speakers. Yeah. So.
Oh, right.
We can probably watch it on the laptop, to be honest.
Can you see it?
Yeah.
Or maybe you can just put it on the table.
Yes. I know. Hang on, though. It's linked to the to the speakers.
Oh, you just get around.
Huh?
Get around it.
Yeah, I guess. See if you've. Yeah, hang on. I'll turn up the volume. And. I'll play it from here, so I can put it on the screen.
What's the matter now? I got this. My ears are filling up. I got this sinus condition. It's the changing temperature. I always get it from the air conditioning.
Like this?
Maybe it'll go away. No, it's all part of my allergies. I get it in the summer.
Like this?
Only in the summer? No, not in the winter, too. I get them all year long. Allergic to foods. And pillows and curtains and perfumes. Can you imagine that? Allergic to perfumes? I used to drive Frances crazy. For a while, she couldn't wear anything except my aftershave lotion. I was impossible to live with. Stop that, will you? What are you doing? I'm trying to clear up my ears. You create a pressure inside your head, it opens up the eustachian tubes.
Not like that.
Did it open up? I think I strained my throat.
Okay. I'll show you what it becomes in Italian. Of course, it can't be as good as, but doesn't matter if you don't understand the word.
Ma che cosa vorresti che facessi? Che la dimenticassi? Come posso dimenticare 12 anni di matrimonio così?
Lo so, ma questi sono i fatti e devi affrontarli. Non puoi passare la vita a piangere. Ti annoia perfino al cinema. Cosa ti prende?
Ho freddo e l'aria condizionata. Ma perché la tengo?
Sorry, you didn't see this bit.
Mi prenderò un'influenza. Mettiamoci a un altro tavolo.
Yeah, we saw it from here.
Scusa, lo sapevo. Che t'ha presa adesso?
No, niente, ho un po' le orecchie che mi si bloccano, ho la sinusite e il cambio di temperatura me lo fa sempre l'aria condizionata.
Vedrai che è una cosa da niente.
No, è una delle mie tante allergie, d'estate mi vengono sempre.
D'estate soltanto?
Non è neanche d'inverno, mi durano tutto l'anno. Sono allergico ai cibi, ai cucini, alle tende e ai profumi. Te lo immagini, uno allergico ai profumi faceva diventare furiosa Francis. Certe volte poteva mettersi solo la mia lozione dopo barba. Era impossibile vivere con me.
Non puoi smetterla?
Cerco di stapparmi le orecchie. Beh, si crea una pressione dentro la testa che stappa le trombe di Eustachio.
E ci sono aperte?
Sì, ma ho sforzato troppo la gola.
Ok, so of course, as I said, it's not as good as Jack Lemmon, but I think you will agree that in terms of sync, is quite good. And it wasn't easy. Now, that clip has shown you what the main problem is, of course. The main problems only occur when you have close-ups. So what you do as a dubbing translator when you're watching a film, you note on the script the position of the characters in the scene. You note whether they are turning their backs on the camera, because that gives you a lot of freedom in terms of, you know, the message. Also, you note if it's a long shot, because in long shots the human figure is quite small and you can't really see the face. And you note those scenes in which you have to be extra careful because it's a close-up or even a detail shot. Okay, so those are challenging. Now, criticisms of dubbing. Linguistic, in terms that sometimes you can't really escape the constraints of the image, and so you end up producing a foreign language version which sounds a bit unidiomatic. So the word dubbies has been coined to refer to the, for example, the variety of Italian spoken in dubbed films. Sometimes you have expressions in those dubbed films that you would never hear a real Italian use. And at the same time, because they are watched by whole masses of viewers, it exerts a powerful pressure on the language and influences the evolution of the language. So, for example, nowadays, a lot of my students, for example, when you ask them for confirmation, instead of saying sì, yes, which is what we always used to say before, they say già. Why? That comes from dubbing. Because in scenes, in American scenes where the character goes, yeah, that's translated as già in Italian because it's roughly the same lip shape. Now, the word già exists in Italian, but it's a temporal adverb that means already. For example, I've already done my homework. Or già fatto I compiti. So it's got nothing to do with saying yes, but through exposure to dubbing, we have become accustomed to it, and people don't even realize that it's not originally the Italian way of using the word. Or, for example, the verb realizzare, it comes from to realize in English, meaning, you know, to realize that something is going on, to become aware that something is going on. The verb realizzare already existed in Italian, but it meant to make something real, to create something. So now it has acquired another meaning through dubbing. And of course, those who are purists of the language and would like to keep the Italian language free from all foreign interferences don't like this kind of thing.
I don't know how it is in Italian or in other languages, but German is full of...
Light has come on.
Full of like new English words, and they call it Denglish,
yes.
Which is super easy, so which makes it easier, right?
Yes. Yes, it does. It does, but at the same time, you have to be really careful what you are translating, because if you can't use the same translation strategies on different genres. So if you're translating costume dramas, you have to avoid Italianglish. What again? What's going on with the power here? Anyway, And also, sometimes you're faced with problems because your own language doesn't really have the linguistic tools to translate the same concept. So a couple of years ago, I studied the Italian dubbing of gay-themed series. I don't know if you've seen any of them. Queer as Folk, The L Word. The first one is about a bunch of gay men in Manchester, and the second one is about a group of lesbian women in Los Angeles. And of course, Italy being a Catholic country, these issues exist, but they're not really openly debated. And so there is a gay lexicon, a gay jargon, but it is mostly used within the gay community. It's not mainstream. So, for example, there are different ways of saying lesbian in American, things like lesbian, but also dyke, and various slang expressions. And the translators did not know what to do with those terms, because if they used the equivalent slang terms used in the Italian gay community, the viewers would not be able to understand it. Then, of course, you also have pressures from the church, who did not particularly like these things being discussed. And so the end result of series a bit sensitive like these, or Sex and the City and so on, they are, you know, mitigated in the Italian version. They're not as raw and as funny as the originals. So that's one risk of dubbing. Perhaps not necessarily official censorship in the original sense of the word. You know, under the fascist regime, it was actual censorship. You cannot talk about these things. So, for example, there was this Alfred Hitchcock film, The 39 Steps, quite famous film from his British period when he was still shooting in London. And there's this guy who's accused of murdering somebody. So he takes the train from King's Cross, the Flying Scotsman, you know, the same train that Harry Potter takes to go to Hogwarts, and escapes to Scotland. And when he gets there, it is very visibly Scotland. You're in the Highlands, you see Highland cows and people wearing kilts and playing bagpipes and things like that, you know, very stereotypical Scotland. But because the film came out in 1939 and Italy was at war, and of course, you know, the UK was the enemy at the time, they could not glorify Albion, as they called it at the time. They could not glorify the UK. And so they changed it completely in translation. And for some bizarre reason, this guy escaped to Canada. And of course, you watch it and you think, if he's in Canada, why is everybody wearing kilts? What is that? So that's censorship, and it is stupid censorship. What I'm talking about here is not so much official censorship, but intercultural differences that exist and that have an impact on what the language can say. So if you are translating a film that comes from a very liberal country, you have difficulties translating that into a language of a country that is less open about certain topics. Think about translating American films into Arabic. All the profanities, they have to be deleted. They don't reproduce. Think about Quentin Tarantino in Arabic. You know, all the swear words, they have to disappear. They don't like that kind of stuff. Okay? They're not used to it. Or think about those films that draw on the literary tradition of a country. So all the costume dramas and period dramas that the Brits are famous for, they're not very easy to translate into certain languages where that kind of tradition does not exist. So I think we have literally just a couple of minutes to finish this off, and then we'll continue with subtitling tomorrow. I'll just say this so that you can bear in mind this kind of information, so we can have a little bit of a discussion tomorrow when we start, about subtitling. I said that the main goal of dubbing is invisibility, meaning that the viewers don't realise that they're watching a film that was originally shot in another language. In subtitling, it's completely the other way around. It's a foreignizing translation method, meaning that it allows you to have access to a different culture and language, And you know that because you're fully immersed in the sounds of that culture as well as the images. But at the same time, your good subtitles are smooth and invisible in the sense that you don't notice them. So if you don't notice them, it means they're done properly. It means you can read them without too much effort, and it means that they reproduce the type of language that you see on the screen in the correct way. What are the main problems? The main problems are time, space, and diamesic shift. Time, because the speed at which the characters speak in the original films is always higher than the reading speed of viewers. So you speak faster than you can read, always. Space, because you have a limited amount of characters per line and you can't cover up too much of the image, because the viewers want to watch the film. They don't want to go to the cinema to read, otherwise they stay at home and read a book. Okay? And diamesic shift, spoken to written. You have to render in writing film dialogues. And that's not always easy, because some of the things that you can say are not necessarily the things that you can write. So, going back to the Quentin Tarantino example before, of course, if you have two characters quarreling and they're quite clearly criminals, you can't edit out all the swear words, but at the same time, you cannot reproduce all those swear words in writing, because otherwise it has a multiplier effect. Seeing those expressions, really strong expressions in writing, has a much stronger impact than hearing them. Okay, so what you do is you try and strike a balance, reproduce two or three, so that viewers understand that these two people don't like each other, but not all of them. And especially some Quentin Tarantino favorite swear words do not have an equivalent in some languages, like motherfucker in Italian doesn't really exist. Is the concept is just so horrendous that we don't have a word for it. We understand it, and there are other ways of conveying the force, the impact, but you have to replace it with something else. And we tend to use swear words that are much more related to the religious sphere, because it's a Catholic country. We tend to, you know, pronounce the word of God in vain quite often. So on this note, I will leave you, or rather, I will close the official part of the workshop, and we'll continue tomorrow, because I think they have another event here. But if, whilst I'm removing this stuff, if you have any more questions, just please ask, no problem, and we can have a chat. I hope that was interesting enough for you.
Yes.
Yes.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.